Hello out there. This is the final episode of this year of The Graft. And this episode is with Dr. Rumu Bihirai, who earned a Doctor of Medicine from the University of Benin, Nigeria, and completed his internal medicine residency at Columbus Hospital in Chicago, Illinois. He completed fellowships in bone marrow transplant and medical oncology in Johns Hopkins University and the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Bihirai has participated in research and is published on the subjects of immunotherapy, lymphomas, and bone marrow transplantation. He is also a member of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, American Society of Hematology, American Medical Association, and the Wisconsin Medical Society.
Up until last week, many people in the hematology world may not have been aware of who Dr. Bihirai was, but his question at the plenary session at ASH brought the attention of the hematology world to the issues with equality, diversity, and how trial results may not necessarily be applicable to the populations they are supposed to represent. Here, we talk about the issues raised with equality and diversity and the practical steps that we can take to try and address this issue.
And as he beautifully put it, it's all about us. Enjoy this conversation with Dr. Bihirai. Is that your office?
Yes. is the light good, or do you want me to turn the light on?
No, it's perfect.
Okay.
It's perfect. I want to have this office. It looks beautiful.
Yes, it's my place of relaxation and place of thinking.
Where are you currently located?
I'm in Indianapolis.
Okay.
I live in a suburb of Indianapolis called Carmel, but I practice in Indianapolis. Yes, I'm a practicing physician. I'm originally of Nigerian descent. I've lived in America for over 30 years, trained in the US, went to medical school in Nigeria, and I've practiced in Indianapolis for 20 years. My training was at the National Institutes of Health and National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, where I trained in medical oncology, and then Johns Hopkins University, where I trained in marrow transplantation. And I'm practicing now. My practice is a general practice, although there are a number of diseases that I've always been drawn to, and one of them being the blood cancers. And because of that, I actually run a program which is called Indy Hematology Review. And Indy Hematology Review is a review course that I've run for the past 18 years, and our 19th year will be coming up in 22. And what we do is we invite the major thought leaders to come to Indianapolis to give their presentations on what is felt to be the most promising data in the year prior. But I'm a practicing physician, which was the question you asked.
Great. And just, I guess, let's get straight to it. So obviously from ASH last weekend, 5 days where we heard about all the latest research developments and everything in every aspect of hematology. And the one thing, I wasn't actually at ASH, but I think everyone following on social media and beyond, the thing that people were talking about was the issue you rose in, you brought up with your question at the plenary session. Were you surprised by the response and how it went down, or?
I was surprised to some extent. I was surprised by, so at least that's the first time I recall that a question is cheered with people clapping for a question. Mm-hmm. And that was moving because this is something that is personal to me. Not simply because I'm African-American, but because I believe that we as a human race have reached a point where science should be available to everyone and data should be applicable to all the patients that we see and treat. When I'm looking at a patient, I should be able to look at that patient in the eye and say, yes, I have data that this applies to you. And when that is not available, or when that is not being looked at as something meaningful, it becomes a personal challenge to each one of us. And so last or 2 years ago, I sat on a committee with the AACR and the FDA to talk about how to diversify and improve enrollment in clinical trials for minorities, and particularly African Americans. And the reason why we chose myeloma was, as you know, myeloma is a disease, at least in the United States, that predominantly affects African Americans, and at least relative to their population in the US. And so we felt that was a low-hanging fruit, in a sense that that was a disease that needed to be, if we cannot improve diversity and enrollment in that disease state, then we're in trouble. And so there was a white paper that was published by the AACR with some recommendations. And then since then, I've talked to a number of pharmaceutical companies or drug developers or research institutes who are interested in this space. But I feel like all we've done is talk. Everyone, if you talk to any of the major companies, they will tell you that they have a diversity, equity, and inclusion committee. But what does it matter if you do and nothing happens? And if you talk to investigators will say, well, we tried to enroll people, it was difficult, so we couldn't. So it's status quo. And some people are hoping that maybe approval agencies would insist that certain quota be met, but that is a political problem. That is hard to do politically. And the reason is because those agencies, their leadership is still appointed by politicians. This is science. So we have to separate science from politics. And so at our last Indy Hematology Review meeting, because I've been thinking about this very subject, we came up with an initiative that we refer to as the DRIVE initiative. And DRIVE is an acronym for 5 major steps that I think if we took, will make an instant and immediate difference in enrollment. The D in DRIVE stands for the fact that every clinical trial ought to have a diversity officer. And think about it like this. Every clinical trial, or at least major clinical trials, phase 3 and maybe large phase 2 studies, have a data safety monitoring board. That is not something that just came out of the blue. That came out because it was understood that it's important that there is an independent group of people monitoring studies for safety, because safety is important. Safety is paramount. If we think that diversity is as important as safety, which I would argue it is, then we need to have a diversity officer. And the role of the diversity officer is someone who monitors the study during the course of the study, so that you don't fall into a situation where you write a paragraph in a study that states, we would make every effort to ensure that there's accrual of minorities and we would shoot for a 20% target, right? And then at the end of the study, well, we tried and we didn't meet our 20% target. But who was monitoring activities in the interim? That should not be on the principal investigators. That should be on this diversity officer who can look and say, well, here are steps you can take at your institution. These are what we should be doing. And really micro-targeted each site so that the diversity goals of that study are met. So that's the D. The R stands for what I spoke about at ASH very, very briefly when I asked the question, which is ranking. See, we are all interested in ensuring that our studies are published, that our studies are presented at major meetings. So you could imagine what would happen to us as investigators if there was a ranking system. Imagine a simple ranking system of 0 to 5. 5 is a study that met diversity goals. And what I mean by diversity goals is that it should be to the disease, not to the population, but to the disease that is being studied. So that if you have a study that was ranked 0, and nothing has happened, but at ASH or at any of the major meetings, ASCO, EHA, ESMO, your diversity target must be reported and you get a rank. And if your rank is zero, it is zero. It will be there for everyone to see. That would change our behavior. And if you're ranked five, that would also change our behavior because everybody will want to be ranked higher. So that's the R. The I is the individual in all of us. In other words, you and Nico are doing this interview because you guys are interested in this subject. You're already making a personal effort to ensure that diversity goals are met. I'm speaking to it. Each one of us have a responsibility because it turns out that diversity doesn't just affect minorities, but it affects all of us in so many ways. One way is economic. If studies are not designed to study all people and adverse reactions occur that were probably not known, the cost is going to be borne by all of us. So there is an economic impact on each one of us. And then we all have a responsibility as human beings on this earth to ensure that our fellow human beings are treated equally. We wouldn't do that to our pets. And so each one of us as investigators, as clinicians, as students, as fellows, have a responsibility to ensure that diversity goals are met, and we need to come up with a diversity plan whenever we are enrolling patients in a clinical study. That's the I. The V is my ultimate step, that studies ought to be verified for meeting those diversity goals and targets. And on the basis of that, podium presentations should be reserved for studies that meet the most diverse goals. So for example, the study I spoke to at ASH, I'm not saying it shouldn't be presented, but maybe it's not a plenary presentation because it does not meet diversity goals. That would change investigators' behavior. And then the E is enhanced training of the clinical team to be diverse. So you need to have a diverse clinical team that includes investigators, that includes patient coordinators, that includes the navigators, that includes the members of the Data Safety Monitoring Board, and that also includes the plenary, the steering committees of clinical trials. Because if you don't include all voices, and if the patients that we're trying to enroll in clinical trials do not see a diverse clinical team, they probably will be less likely to enroll. So we, in pushing this initiative, one of our next steps are that we are going to have a summit in Indianapolis in September. And we will be inviting all major players, ranging from government approval agencies like the FDA to payers, to major clinical investigators, to major societies like ASH, like ASCO, so that we all can come up with what I'm referring to as the Indianapolis Black Paper. And the Indianapolis Black Paper is meant to then reach, hopefully, this set of goals that I just proposed. And we all agree, and hopefully even publishers. So for example, journal chief editors should also incorporate all of this. If we follow all of this, I think our clinical enrollments will change and our behavior will change as a community of treating physicians.
It's really astonishing. So I've never heard some kind like a structure you install to tackle this discussion, to be honest, because in our generation is usually faced with obviously a discussion on diversity, inequality, equity, but it's all somehow intermingled with emotions, with morals, and with hierarchies, etc. So I really, really like that you try to make this scientific and to leave out the whole emotional part that's obviously in this kind of discussion always.
Yes.
Let me ask you two questions. One is, how do you define diversity? Do you think that's a question that needs to be answered in specific areas, for instance? So diversity in Germany may be completely different, or in UK may be different to the US, for instance.
Yes.
How do you think are, especially like international studies, how should they be designed or addressed this?
Yeah, so absolutely. That's a very, very important point. First of all, the diversity should be self-reported. I don't think we should go around and say, hey, who are you and what are you? You're not who you are, right? That will make it crazy. So it should be self-reported. And it has to include all of the elements that makes us different. And race is just one of them, but race is not all of it. And it has to include gender. It has to include, age, young and older. Typically a lot of the studies have younger people and people who are older excluded. That also doesn't reflect the patients that we treat. Even potentially disease states. For example, as an investigator, and I've written clinical trials, there is a habit that we all have. And one of those is that there is a lot of copy and pasting of exclusion criteria. So you don't even ask yourself why. So for example, people with HIV disease who have controlled HIV disease, why shouldn't they be in clinical trials? People with hepatitis that is controlled. So we need to do all of that. And then, so referring to nations, I think each nation and each society should define for themselves what their diversity are. So in the US, race is a major factor. In Germany, probably it's not that, maybe it's more nationality. In the UK, probably nationality and race. So it's dependent on that society. And I think some of those things can be refined. And you do bring up that important point that we have to do this in a way that is non-emotional so that we don't get into the politics of diversity and then it destroys the science. We should understand what the point is. The point is including as many people of different characteristics in a clinical study so that the clinical results are applicable and useful to the entire population.
Completely agree. Really, you just say things that I completely agree with. It's awkward. The other thing is that these are all like topics you do kind of a priori. So you do that before you start doing your science.
Yes.
The other thing that I would like to share with you, because that's why I sat in the plenary session, and it was really for me really, really important, because your point is completely new, is completely relaxed and from objective point of view. And on next to me there sat a friend of mine from Mexico. And he raised the point that at the conclusion of the study, which was on cellular therapy, CAR T cell therapy, he said basically, when there was pointed out, okay, this should be the new standard of care. And he simply said, well, what's the standard of care in Mexico? So we don't even have CAR T cell therapy at the last line of therapy. So we now need to move it in like a second line, even as first line. So what's the definition of standard of care in different socioeconomical scenarios? What do you think of that? How do you also plan to include this point of different financial issues, socioeconomics in your discussion?
Yes, and it is. So think about it. I think our societies are going to go bankrupt if we continue on this path. Even the richest of societies are going to go bankrupt. This is not sustainable. And why is it not sustainable? So for example, look at the study that was presented at ASH. So the study makes that statement. You know, it becomes a new standard of care. And the implication is anyone with relapse refractory diffuse large cell lymphoma ought to get cellular therapy up front. There's not an attempt to understand the patients who got the best benefit and say, maybe for this group of patients, there should be a benefit. And in fact, Tuesday's session, which was the late breaking abstract, I'm not sure if you were there, there was also another study presented, the Bellini trial, which was a negative trial. And I asked Dr. Michael Bishop from the University of Chicago what he thought the statement of the standard of care should be. And he said, potentially it is the standard of care maybe for patients who relapse within 6 months. That is a more reasonable and rational way of thinking of this. And I think part of the reason why you have all of this is that I can bet you that if you look at the principal investigators and the steering committee for that Zuma 7 trial, it was probably more homogeneous than you would want to be. And so the voices that come out of that become so homogeneous because everyone is thinking in the same way. You know, even in those clinical trials, frequently, I practice in the community. I have an academic appointment and I'm a professor of clinical medicine at the Marion University here in Indianapolis. I have fellows and I have students and I have residents that we train, but I'm not a primary academic. So my voice or voices like mine are not going to be heard when a study like that is designed. And so when conclusions are reached, you're not going to have those kinds of voices. So you have just one set of voices from the ivory tower. And whereas that might be good, if you do not have other voices seeping in so that the conclusions are reflective of real life characteristics, then we're missing a point. And then how do these results apply to the rest of the world? We have to look at things globally. So I agree with you.
And for us as trainees, what do you think we as trainees can do to try and help this and all these practical steps that it feels, hopefully, are as optimistic as we can be that things are actually going to start happening?
Yes. So one of the ideas that I have, which is not part of the drive, but I think it's kind of part of it, is among the next steps is that we ought to have a way of learning how to measure these outcomes. See, this is an intersection of social science and medicine in terms of how to measure some of these, you know, potential effects of what we're recommending. And that's not something we learn in medical school or in training. And so I think we ought to not just have a conversation about diversity, but we ought to begin to challenge ourselves in training to say, okay, what steps should we take as next steps? So that just as part of your training, when you're reviewing clinical data, you look at the data and you say, okay, here are the weaknesses. It doesn't meet this diversity. What could have been done in this particular study? So that this study could then meet those targets. If that became part of our thinking and it's incorporated into your training and the training of medical students, then I think it will become so ingrained in all of us that our generation will be the obsolete generation and your generation will be so used to doing it that you will say, what the hell are they talking about? We do this anyway. It's part of what I do. It's part of your DNA, you know, that is how it has to happen. I have a daughter who's a pre-med student and she will be graduating in June. And she showed me a letter where her university, it's now beginning to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion in health sciences. And I think that's where it really should start, at the pre-med level, where you're beginning to talk about it, you're forced to then think about it in your practice. But I think right now, what can you do? What you're doing, highlighting the problem and thinking of practical solutions, because my drive solution is the solution that I can think of. But I'm sure there are many more voices that can come into this and come up with solutions. And part of the reason why I had some of the ranking and some of those criteria that will force us into thinking is so that we are forced into coming up with solutions. Because I think when society is forced to come up with solutions, that is when society does its best. You think about it. Everyone talks about, you know, the weather and global warming and the climate change. 30 years ago, no one could have imagined that 20% of cars on roads could be battery operated cars. It is a challenge that is forcing us to think in those directions. Are we doing enough? Probably not, but at least we're being forced to come up with solutions. So we need to challenge ourselves and force ourselves into coming up with solutions.
Another point I just completely agree with. I would also underline that what I really like is, again, the systematic approach you take. Because for some people as ours, we like are used to think like globally or just humanely to say, okay, yeah, it's obvious if I have a diverse patient population in front of me in the clinic, it's obvious that it needs to be represented in science. But just to talk about it, maybe not good enough. You need to tackle this in a systematic way. That's why we want to do that with our committee. And that's why it's so important you highlight this program of yours. And we will be completely happy to share this with all our young colleagues, because I think it's a really, really fruitful idea. I just want also to ask you, because you talk about challenges, and when you started saying that if we continue our path as we do now, and as we did for the last, let's say, two decades, it will somehow bankrupt our societies. I will follow you up on this. What do you mean by that? Do you think that this is a financial problem or a societal problem? What do you think will happen if we don't change something?
So if you think about it, science was when, in the past, when new therapies became available, they were affordable. And we are now at a point where the new therapies are so expensive. And it is true that they are labor intensive, and we need to do one so that we can advance care and treatments for our patients. But we need to do them in a manner that is financially sustainable. And here's what I mean. And a car is not a human being, obviously. But if you were going to develop technology that you were going to deploy in a car that you intend to sell to the masses, and the technology costs $500,000 for each car, the masses are not going to drive that car. It doesn't matter how that technology is. And so we have these new therapies, you know, like CAR T therapy, right now in the US is at least $1 million per patient. And if it becomes second line therapy, how do we afford it even in the US? And then not to talk of the rest of the world. Is that sustainable? So not only should our research be forward looking, but our research should also look at ways of bringing costs down so that they can become applicable in a more generalized manner to the patients that we care for, not just in resource rich countries, but also in resource limited countries. But I don't know that we are doing that kind of work.
Yeah, the other thing is that we are fighting for is, because we noticed that with especially CAR T, and that's why it's really, yeah, it's a coincidence that the whole discussion started with a CAR T therapy study, that we notice in training around the globe that this new therapy is a huge point of inequality in medical training. Because now, for instance, also in Germany, which is a small country, there is a huge difference if you train in a center which has CAR T-cell therapy or you don't. And if you want to advance your knowledge in medical research, that completely negates your drive to acquire this. Because then you need to apply to go to this hospital. And if that's a problem in Germany, then it is a huge problem in the rest of the country and the rest of the world, especially South America, or even maybe in your United States, I imagine.
Yeah, no, it is. So that rural communities. So talking about diversity, remember how you talk about how do we define diversity? You know, that also includes rural communities. One of the reasons why these therapies are difficult to deploy is that patients in rural communities may not want to leave their communities. You know, so there are logistical challenges that come with that. But we need to think of science more broadly to say, how do we make this more broadly applicable? This should not be in selected centers. Now, there are going to always be some therapies that are unique to specific institutions. That's understandable. But when something becomes, quote unquote, the standard of care in the second line setting for a disease as common as diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, then it needs to be more available.
Yeah.
It needs to be more available. Otherwise, then the science is already such that it's maybe the technology is not the technology that ought to be moving forward. You know, so at least as you see, some of the bispecific antibodies, I think, are probably more realistic as therapies that could be deployed, in this space, and probably will ultimately replace something like CAR T therapy if CAR T therapy is not designed in a way that it becomes more user-friendly. But part of the reason is because you look at the studies, if the studies are done in major academic centers only, then there's not even a challenge to do it in a more rural or smaller community. And that is part of the diversity goals that studies like this ought to meet.
And how do you think we can get the big pharma companies and people interested and to realize the importance of this and to obviously ultimately help all this happen, because clearly the financial gains that they get from having these big expensive therapies are what keeps them going. How do we try and balance it out so that they're interested and they want to lobby to help people in the rural communities, in the low and middle income countries?
I think part of it is, so if you look at maybe the ranking that we talked about, let's say that was implemented, and, because I think you could start out by saying, okay, these are initial goals for that ranking, and you could continue to deploy it until it is more representative of society. And so something like, the applicability of the therapy to a more generalized population becomes a factor for which they are ranked, that I think will force them to begin to think of how to deploy a therapy like this in a more diverse manner, in a manner that can be applicable to the rest of the world, irrespective of resource status. So I don't think you can legislate it, because it would be too tough. But as clinicians, if we make those demands, and we continue to make those demands, then they will begin to listen, because ultimately it's about the profits. And if those kinds of demands are being heard over and over, that's going to push on their potential bottom line. And I think that will change their behavior. Even investors, will begin to say, well, I don't want to be associated with a treatment that is not applicable to everyone.
I really like that. The other point that would just maybe share an experience, maybe see what you think about, because I also like really the point to sensitize people without being like forceful and tell them what they need to think about. We noticed that in our younger generation that there is clearly there, you can't avoid this discussion of diversity, but sometimes or even more than it should be, in my experience, it's also hijacked from like to acquire certain, let's say, positions or to just get on the train to use that as leverage and without really meaning it, without really changing something. That's what bugs me a bit, is that that's why I really like your approach, because I've never heard a neutral and objective discussion about that over the last few months, because it's also, we know it's all emotional, it's all it getting to the bones of people. What do you think? Do you also made that experience when you try to establish your program? Or
yes, and this is the way one of the driving ways or one of the factors that I've used in this process is that it reminds me of the civil rights era. Now we're talking politics in a way, but here's why I say that. There were several approaches in the US to try to quote unquote win civil rights for Black people. But ultimately, I think one of the most effective methods was the method that was deployed by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which is speak to the hearts of people and create a coalition of all people and not an us versus them, but rather it is all of us that are affected. And I think if you saw it that way, then you realize that in order to win this, if we were to even use the word win, everyone has to buy in. Shaming people in the sense of calling them names, it's not gonna get you there. But if we understood the science, how it affects all of us, and then we say, oh my gosh, this is important, this is what we're gonna do about it, and come up with these objective solutions that are agnostic of politics, then we can be successful. So the trick is to speak to it without making anyone feel stupid or feeling that they are evil. It's not us versus them, it's all of us. And so at our summit in Indianapolis, that's why we're going to include people from industry. We're going to have the manufacturers there, because it's not us versus them. It's, hey, how can we tackle this together?
That's a perfect ending, I think, for this conversation. We really, really, really appreciate your being with us, and you responded so quickly and to that very timely matter. And we would really like to spread your program, if that's okay with you.
Yes.
And to share this with our young community.
Yes, right now that program is gonna be on September the 9th of 2022 in Indianapolis. And I will keep you posted, Nico. Mm-hmm. And maybe we could even invite you to come to Indianapolis.
Obviously, yeah, sure, definitely. Because, we're just getting started and we really need to do something about it. And we would be really happy to collaborate.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Have a good day. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.